Welcome to Cuéntame USA with Moncho Camaro. Today is a wonderful day. I'm going to have a conversation with an awesome person. It's going to be a real pleasure to talk to Jo Quell. She's a cellist and composer from the London, UK, across the ocean. She incorporates a really vast and wide musical genres in her music. And we can name a bunch of them. Dark ambient music, some, modern and classical music, progressive, even some metal, I don't know, so much stuff. She has no boundaries, and I guess she has no default musical settings. So we're going to talk to her about her new project, her new album, some the other albums, which are great. And maybe I did do a summary of her career, if she wants to do that. If not, we'll talk about whatever she wants. I don't really care anymore. Whatever, she's here, that's all I care. So we're going to say hello to Jo. How are you, Jo? Jo, miss, how are you doing?
Oh, hi, Jose. I'm very, very well, thank you. And it's a great pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been wonderful. I feel like, let me tell you, I've been interviewing many artists and musicians. I'm always sincere with my audience. Sometimes it takes a while for me to get into it, and I do try to do a lot of research, depending of who the artist is, so do some research. Let me tell you, I've been researching so much stuff about Jo that I've been learning so much. So it's a great pleasure, after doing all this research, to have her up. So I'm really happy. Let me tell you, I'm happy. It's a happy day for me. Okay. Sometimes I look like a little, like, you know, like a dull face. I feel like I have not too much energy. Today I have a lot of energy. Let me tell you, even if it's so early, we're going to talk about her. I'm crazy. Her looping techniques are like unbelievable. The way I see her play. So we're going to find out all the stuff about her. So let me tell you also, she's very busy. Busy schedule. She's always working, seems like. I don't know. I'm going to ask her, do you have any dates in your calendar for vacation this year?
Yeah, we will take a family holiday. We have a daughter who's school age, so we take family holidays during the summertime. So a week or so. Yes. But there are also other days here and there where we do activities. So I do take plenty of days off. It's currently, we're starting what's half term over here. So in the middle of the semester, the week break. So we will have some, we'll go to some places and.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good to me, because I did this research and I found out she did a vacation and she went to the Canary Islands. And like, oh, yes. Oh boy, beautiful landscape, Lanzarote, yes. Lanzarote with a
Lanzarote. Yeah. See, somewhere I find that particular island very, very inspiring, and the island of La Palma as well, which is where I wrote a volcano song, funnily enough, from Caldera, my second album.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and that was the landscape in these islands. Shut me up if I'm going off on a tangent, but I find the landscapes very inspiring. When I first start to write a piece of music, I took several hikes right across the Caldera in La Palma.
Okay.
The same landscape in Lanzarote. When you're very, very high up, the colours are muted, and sort of these greys and reds, and these colours, and all of the anything that grows there is very, very small because it's so windswept, very low. And this is the sort of landscape I sense that I'm in when I'm first beginning to write a piece of music. And actually, I mean, this was the landscape I was trying to describe right at the start of The Cartographer as well. So it feels like you begin at the top, and as you write the music, you make your way down the volcano. And then when you have sort of created something, it's almost like the vista opens out, you know. So this is why I particularly love the Canary Islands for this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Being from Spain, I've never been there. I feel embarrassed. She knows more about the Canary Islands than I do.
There's some beautiful concert halls actually over there as well. In Lanzarote, there's the Jameos del Agua, which has a huge concert hall built into the volcano itself. It's lovely.
I will have to visit.
You will.
I will. You seem to me like a very modest and unpretentious person. Always like straightforward, I guess.
Yeah.
You got a very friendly character. It looks, you know, does this treat, does it run in the family, or you're like a very special person?
Jose, I can be a diva when I need to be or when I want to be. But I think I don't know. It's a very nice thing that you say. I mean, we are a family of we're just a loving family, you know, with a messy kitchen, and the music is my life. Being a mother is my life. Being a wife, being a daughter, everything. There is no separation in these things. It's, you know, that's all.
You began your music career at a very early age. So 5 years old, 6 years old? How old were you when you started? I was playing in Cowboys and Indians at 5 and 6 years old. I was...
Well, as I was too, but we were very lucky because at the time there was a project offered to all inner London primary school children. And of course, it was much smaller. This was like 1,000 years ago. So it was much more containable then. And this project was offered to give free violin or cello lessons to every child who wanted it in inner London.
Okay.
So it was a wonderful project. The organization still exists, but the ethos behind it is slightly different. Naturally, it became much larger, so it had to become fee paying. But at the time, it was offered for free. I never would have taken up the cello otherwise. We always had a piano in the house, and my mum, she plays piano. And so I can remember sitting next to her when I was very, very little and just playing, you know, middle C. And so, I've been very lucky to have opportunities and to have encouragement from people as well. That's the biggest thing.
But the cello wasn't your primary instrument.
Well, actually, I didn't want to play anything at all. So when the letter first came round, I said no to it. But then one semester later, when, you know, we age five, one family went to live in Germany. So there was a place in the class. So I went with my best friend in order to presumably not do something else that was happening in the school day. and then that was it. You know, my first tiny little quarter-sized cello with Inner London Education Authority was scratched into the bottom of it. And that was, I will never forget that ever, that moment, you know. Wonderful.
That was wonderful. So I was going to ask you, I have so many questions. You joined the London School Symphony Orchestra when you were like a teenager, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So the London School Symphony Orchestra, this organization I described to you, the ones that offered the string teaching.
Right.
They also had a series of orchestras. So there was the London Junior Strings, String Ensemble, London Concert Orchestra, and then the London School Symphony Orchestra. And so you kind of naturally progressed through those. And playing in the London School Symphony Orchestra was fantastic because obviously I was introduced to a lot of big orchestral repertoire, as if Mahler or Debussy or this, that, and the other, Sibelius. And I had the opportunity to perform in concert halls, the big concert halls in London, and to learn the discipline of performing as part of a much larger ensemble, the individual responsibility, even as part of a section within a symphony orchestra, and just basically how things work in this way. And you know, it sounds rather obvious probably, but getting to know all of the instrument families, because you're sitting in a rehearsal, you're listening to the brasses, the woodwinds, right, percussions, whatever else going on. So now I do a lot of orchestration of my own work, and this has been invaluable as a training band, actually having the experience of sitting in the orchestra and knowing what these things are going to sound like.
But it gave you also, because you didn't want to fit, like, is that you didn't really enjoy playing what was written for you, like very strict, for like no freedom to create other composition. I don't know how to say.
Yes,
that.
Yes. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. So that is something that happened. Being part of that orchestra, and then I went on after that to take a degree in music. And during that period of time, I began to realize that I was not passionate, as some of my friends were, about this particular side of performing music. And I felt that I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that it wasn't to be an orchestral player. And at the time, there was not really any kind of... Now we have people like Apocalyptica, we have Tina, we have all sorts of wonderful cellists doing wonderful things, very exciting things. But at the time, that wasn't happening. And so for me, I think perhaps because I wasn't very mature in my mind either. So I wasn't a diva, Jose, you know, so I wasn't able to say, this is not right for me. Instead, I crept away bit by bit, you know, and I took my music degree, performance degree. Got a good degree, but then I stopped playing for several years because I just didn't feel that I knew how I didn't have the voice in my cello to say the things I wanted to say musically. So I stopped.
How about your friends in school? Were they into the same type of music that you were, or they were outsiders?
Well, it was great actually, because in my high school, I was a bit of a weirdo because I played the cello, you know, and I went to a pretty rough state school that actually was a phenomenal school. But you certainly had to be able to take care of yourself. And if you did anything kind of extraordinary, well, not extraordinary, but unusual, like playing the cello, then you were the target for, you know, lightweight bullying and stuff. But what was interesting is at the time, I mean, it was musically, it was a very interesting time. So there was all sorts of things going on. I had a great teacher at that school. So my music education was outside of school, but the music classes, I had a very, very great teacher who's sadly passed away now, but he introduced lots of different things into the music lessons. And so things, whereas I would have a full-on classical training outside of school, in school we had, you know, there was sort of, hip-hop, early R&B and stuff like that, lots of metal going on, lots of interesting, diverse styles, lots of world music as well, some projects with Bajat Khan and you know, non-Western musicians. So it was a really big introduction to an awful lot of sound. So it's good.
Were there like a big record collection in your house? Was there like cassettes or CDs? What do you have?
Yeah. So my dad, the record collection really was my dad's. My dad had the Kinks, Tony Joe White, Pink Floyd, Melanie, you know, all sorts of bits and pieces. My mum's tastes were much more into sort of the classical side of things. And my mum actually became very, very interested in contemporary music, and particularly contemporary music for amateur or non-professional ensembles, which because it had been really quite a sort of an elitist, in some respects, an elitist sort of form of, you know, very, very, not necessarily as accessible as it could be. Okay. But anyway, all these things blended in together.
So little by little. I guess for you, that your musical career is being a step-by-step process, you know, like gradually advancing.
Yes, yes.
But always striving forward, I guess.
Yes, yes.
So when you play in different ensembles, musical bands and groups that I've seen, I was listening to some of the EPs from Hush the Many. I said, let me listen to them. Yes.
Wow. Gosh, thank you.
Yeah. The fuck, man. It was very interesting. I really enjoyed the music. And you were part of them, but not at the beginning, right? You were...
That's correct. Yeah. So they were a three-piece, and they supported me when I was touring with an Australian artist in the UK. This was years and years and years ago. Right. And when I saw them on stage, I heard their music, music. I really felt very drawn to them. And then I was able to meet them after the show, and we discussed perhaps playing together. And actually Ruben, who's he was the guitarist in Hush and the Many, he is now, he's my husband, so that's how I met him.
Is Ruben Nima, is that his name? No.
So no, Nima is the singer, Nima? And then there was Nima Alex was the on bass, okay. And Ruben on guitar.
Ah, yeah. Okay, so I know, now I know. I saw four of them. It's I think the singer was I don't know if it was bleeding from her hands or something.
Nima. Nima. Yes, he tended to get quite physically involved in the performance. Very charismatic man.
Yeah, you know. It felt like Iggy Pop when he was know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. So many things I want to talk to you about. When was the first time you started doing some looping technique? Who showed you how to do that, or how did it get to your attention? Like something that you really wanted to do.
Well, that was Ruben, actually, and okay. It was because of Hush the Many. So Ruben used to use a Line 6 pedal for looping, and this was a pedal that it was a multi-effects pedal, but it had 14 seconds of loop time, or 28 if you halved your speed.
Okay.
And he just lent it to me one day and said, try that out. And at that moment, the world opened. You see, the thing is, Jose, I have been used to the sound of a cello ensemble, because when I was little, at the Centre for Young Musicians in the school project, I explained to you, there were lots of us playing the cello, too many for an orchestra. So we would rotate, and many times there would be the orchestra, and then there would be a cello ensemble of, say, 12 cellists. And so I was used to the sound of multiple cellos. So when I started looping then, as an older person, it was a sound I was so familiar with, and I felt so comfortable. Very simple. I started very simple, just one or two notes and then making some chords. But the possibility was there, and perhaps also the memory of this really enjoyable period of time when I was taught that this sound came back to me. And then I moved on to the Boss pedals, because they had slightly more flexibility. I have always used Boss pedals, and now... all the way through their series. And now I use the RC600, which is their flagship loop station, which is a phenomenal piece of equipment.
Yeah, because I'm seeing you playing with them, with the RC600, uh-huh. Also the 300, I think I saw some videos.
Yeah, yeah, 300, yeah, as well.
That you used in the previous albums.
And I used to use the RC20, 30, 50, all of them. I've got them all in the garage. You could have like a museum of Boss pedals here.
But do you still use them or not? You got them like...
I use them. I take them out sometimes when I'm doing workshops, because they are still very, very good pedals. And they're also possible for people. If people are curious about looping, they can usually pick one up on eBay or something for a very sensible amount of money. So many improvements have been made to the pedals as they go on. But if you're just starting out in looping, then I find if I'm doing a workshop, these are the ones that people can try out with and they feel inspired by. So yes, I do use them. I wouldn't take them on the stage now, only the 600,
right.
Because the quality is much larger. Yeah.
Do you teach in university or some classes?
I do. Yeah, so I teach at an online university. We've got students from all over the world. And it's professional media composition, orchestration, and songwriting and music production. So my students are all sorts of people from all walks of life, all very, very passionate, very, very skillful composers too. So it's a privilege to, you know, just walk with them on this journey.
Mm-hmm. So... did you decide to start your, you launch your own solo career in the early 2010, was it?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's when you decided to step away from other like projects with other, you've been collaborating with so many people. It's like you're never on your own. It's like you're always dealing with other musicians, but your solo project started in 2010. That's when.
That's right.
Yeah. And why did you decide to start on your own, like doing your own music?
Well, I mean, there were several reasons, but the primary reason was that I Because I'd started to play the cello again after this hiatus, I was very much enjoying playing in bands, but there was something in the back of my mind that was saying to me, no, you have to take 100% control of what you're doing just for a period of time. I didn't intend it to be a fully fledged solo career forever and ever, but it was very important to me, I think, to have this. It was almost, it was like a kind of a birth of sorts. I wanted to have complete control over every single aspect of sound that I was doing. And perhaps it's a, you know, just deeply psychological, I'm sure, but I enjoyed the process very much. I enjoyed the creative freedom. I also enjoyed the responsibility, but I was very lucky because I had friends around me. So I had a gentleman called Ben Matthews, who was a very, very supportive man and helped me to record. I had other people who were would contribute some spoken word, Mohan Rana, or some instrumentation. But I was in charge of it. And this was a very important move for me, I think.
Yeah. So your first record is From the Sea in 2010.
Yes.
In this album, do you use your acoustic cello, but also both the electric Starfish cello, both of them on this album?
I use both. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
There's so many songs I enjoyed. The last one is, I think, the heaviest one. I don't know. Fair Forward, probably.
Fair Forward, yeah. Fair Forward is interesting because that was each of the albums that I've done has been a signpost by accident to what I'm going to do next. So Fair Forward actually was a signpost to what was coming quite a long way later when I began to feel that it was okay to experiment with broadly with sound. But yeah, From the Sea, interestingly, the first track on that album is a track called Rex Infractus. And that is one that I play. I didn't play it for years and years. And now it's part of my set. But the track has developed so much. It's huge now.
Yeah. Because confidence. I saw it on YouTube, I think, that in some venue that you played that one.
Yes, exactly. It's very different now. I mean, it's got big, like, ram of sound.
Yes.
But a lot of space. So it honors the original track. But I knew that there was something else to be said with that piece of music. But at the time, I didn't have the vocabulary, if you like, in the first album. Now I have the vocabulary and now it says what I wanted to say. So
yeah, it's so great.
It takes time.
I listened to all these albums. I told Jo that I really had no idea who she was till like 3 months ago. So I apologize for that. You miss, there's so much music outside that you don't know about. And you probably, you're never gonna hear, and that's bad. I wish I could listen to the good music only, but sometimes you're wasting time listening to the other stuff that you have to get to the music that you love. Sometimes you miss it and you're never gonna listen, but it's impossible. It's like meeting nice people. There are so many nice people out there you're never gonna find. Yeah. But you're going to find a lot of crazy cuckoos also. So, you know, it's just how life is.
Yeah.
There's a song also from that album that it took me, this Mosquito song. I don't know. I listened to that song. When it starts, I thought it jumps into like a little flamenco. I don't know. It sounds to me at the beginning, but then it moves away totally from that.
Yeah.
But I remember that, listening to that song also. Like, there's so much stuff. It was a good start, I guess, From the Sea for you. It was, you got a lot of recognition for that album. And
comparatively speaking, given that from a standing start, if you like, from a place of no recognition to there, The Falconer, which is on that record, proved to be a very popular track. Sometimes I play that one again. It's actually a very useful track to teach with because it's possible to perform that whole track just on a single channel loop. Provided you can undo the last thing you put in, you can perform The Falconer. So I have it scored and I use it in these sorts of environments just to teach people a very basic, not basic in a negative way. So it's a gentle and very possible way to loop. So it encourages, you know, it's not difficult to get going if you use this type of approach.
also your influence, your inspiration, which is, I don't know. Some people say there is no inspiration. It's just hard work. If you don't work hard, there is no inspiration. If for you, what it is, it's both. You got to work really hard. And that you need inspiration from other influences like that are drawn, like poetry, or it could be psychology, nature, paintings, yeah. Everything,
yeah, art. Exactly, exactly. So. But you have to. I think it's you have to work hard. So yes, the inspiration will come from anywhere and from other sounds, from other tracks, right. From other unrelated genres. But you must have, I think, the desire to translate that inspiration into your own artistic output, which hopefully then will inspire somebody else to make their artistic output. That's the hard work. That's what takes hours and hours and days and months of time.
Right.
The initial inspiration is there, like a big kind of glowing ember, and then you must put the right energy into this in order to make it fully flourish, you know?
Right. But when you construct your compositions, they don't come from a specific theme or a concept. Does it come only from one? It comes from different concepts at the same time? You span on it, like yeah. You build it. It takes a configuration and I don't know.
Yeah. Each album has had a different starting point. So you, for example, Five Incantations, I was very interested in exploring what I call the cardinal energies in that. So it's earth, air, fire, water, and spirit. And each of those pieces was created once the DNA had been discovered, if you like, of the piece, then that piece was created with those energies in mind. Now, in terms of, I remember, for example, with Salamander, I started to write that piece.
Great piece of work. Yes, I heard that.
Thank you.
I listened to that many times. Salamander and Gold.
Oh, Gold. Yeah, Gold has been very,
still
very
play,
popular.
I play that one also.
Very, I play it regularly.
It's
I can't
great.
Not play it because it's often the one that if nobody knows anything at all, they may have heard Gold. So Gold is one that I have to, I love to play it as well, but when I put it in a set, it's greeted warmly usually. Salamander is interesting because the starting point of Salamander was, I remember being in a studio in East London doing some preparation for a tour, and I was just mucking about basically, and then suddenly this little riff thing came, and that was what became Salamander. And I was interested at that point in starting to use polyrhythms on the loop, so basically two rhythmic cycles running against each other, and experimenting with how you can do this on a loop station. And the way you can do it is to make your bar length as short as possible. So if you have like two beats in a bar, or even one beat in a bar, then that means you can run, for example, 15 beats over 16 beats if you want to. I mean, that's one wouldn't want to do that because that's too fine and too confusing. But with Salamander, I run the opening of the piece of music has seven beats in a bar. And when we come to the end, I've run effectively four beats in a bar. So the sevens get massaged into the longer framework, but they're still running at the same time. And doing this on a loop station, this was exciting. But the interesting thing is, this is something I'm working on a lot at the moment, is when you have a studio version of a piece of music, this is one thing. When you put it out live, it's much better if you can make it as primary colored as possible, outlined in black Sharpie each phrase, because the nuances that we spend ages working on in the studio very often will not translate fully in a live setting. And that's not because of the equipment or anything else. It's usually because of the size of the room, the PA system, how many people are in the hall. All these things affect how the sound is built. So this is another thing I spend a lot of time working on, is how to separate sounds, separate lines, all coming out of one stereo feed. How can we get this type of movement? So
I'm learning a lot of stuff, let me tell you, because I'm not a musician. I love music, but all my pianos and guitars, it's decoration. It's my daughters play music. I listen.
Great.
I listen. Great. They play and I listen.
Wonderful.
So I knew I was going to learn a lot today, and I'm learning. And my listeners, the musicians, they know more than myself about what she's talking about. I'm learning. I think I'm going to have to take a class online with Joe.
Yeah, come to class. It'd be a
I'll start from the beginning because, you know, I cannot... I'm learning a lot.
It's a great place to start.
Right? I never seen you play live, you know. I hope I can see her one day.
I've
seen
so
many videos I've seen about her online now. And it's a delight to see her play her instrument.
Well,
the way she like undulates and sways her body, you know, she weeps. I don't know. It's incredible to watch for me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so here's the thing. So if any of your listeners have any connections with booking agents, so I would love to come and play in America, but it's very, very difficult to get.
You've been touring all over the world, Europe and Australia and Japan, I think you made it.
Yes, that's
yes.
right. Yes.
But I haven't seen anything in the United States, that's true. I haven't seen
anything.
I'm probably only on vacation. She came to New York.
I've never been.
You've never been?
All, never been to the States or to Canada.
That's unbelievable. So, I cannot believe it. Not even a vacation?
No.
Well, there's not much to see anyway.
I would love to come and play. And
I'll carry your starfish cello. I'll carry it for you. Don't worry, nobody's going to steal it because it's for you probably something like a family thing. It's like, imagine if it gets stolen.
Let's not.
That would be... that would be great to carry her stuff. But like I say, she's always like laser focus play on stage. And what I noticed also, she plays, I saw her sitting, but not too many times, but so always standing up, playing. Mm-hmm. You got to do a lot of exercise because standing up for a couple of, even in an hour, you need to be in good shape. You got to, you know, your legs don't get tired of holding the, you know, standing up is not like sitting a little bit. I don't know.
No, well, there's several reasons. So I don't know if you can see, you might not be able to see.
I see it over there. Yes, I do see it.
So he's standing on his stand at the moment. And that stand was made for me by a blacksmith here in London, Kevin Boys, fabulous master craftsman. The stand is better for me if I'm on my own on a stage, which I am a lot of the time,
right?
Then it's easier for me to handle a stage standing up. It's just a personal preference. So if I'm performing, for example, when I performed at Hellfest, I was a soloist in front of 6,000-7,000 metal fans.
Right.
So I can go to a stage, stand up, be big and broad, occupy that space because I'm standing. Also, it's necessary for what I do with the looping and the multi-effects. So there's lots of pedals. I can't do it if I'm sitting down. But the point you made is very interesting, quite accurate, because actually, when you play the cello sitting down, we think that we are using our arms and our hands. We aren't. We're using our whole body. So when I teach cello, we're often talking about our back, our hips, our legs, feet, jaw, neck, all these things. The same applies when you're playing standing up. The techniques that you can rely on when you're seated, you cannot rely on when you're standing. So shifts, for example, the way I prepare for a shift on the cello, an octave from here to here, seated is one way. Standing, the whole body needs to approach from a different way in order to make this shift. So there was a lot of that is a part of playing which I've become more and more and more familiar with and comfortable with as the years have gone on. But when I first started playing standing up, I didn't feel able to play anything other than basic stuff in what we call first position, which is down here on the neck. It was really interesting, Jose. Yeah. You know?
It's very physical. It's more physical than it appears when you look.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It's really, it's unbelievable for me. It's not like like you play the guitar and you go all over the stage moving from side to side. It has to be in a spot for you. Yes. You cannot move around much, only use your feet and to play the pedals and stuff, but it's not like you can move around.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's like it's very, very interesting. And you keep pushing the boundaries of your cello. It's like you're trying to get this all the sounds that come out of the cello. She's looking for even more sounds, whatever she can get more out of it. So it's like,
I know what you're doing there. Yeah. With the acoustic cello, so I've got my acoustic. Here's just that.
Oh, here it is, yes.
So this one, there's a lot of things we would call them extended techniques. So we learn how to play the cello and make a nice sound.
Right.
Then we learn, or we can explore the other possibilities of sound. So, for example, if you're using your bow very, very close to the bridge, you're going to get, depending on how you use it, you're going to get quite an abrasive sound.
Right.
Which then, if you translate that technique onto the electric cello, if you use a little bit of delay and some reverbs, perhaps it's a little bit of sound modeling, you use that same technique and suddenly you've got this very alien landscape of sound that's being created, and it's all from essentially quite a simple technique on the cello, and one which is often told to people that it is the wrong way to play. It's wrong to play like that, but I say no, it's not wrong, it's a sound. You use it when you need it. And so when I write pieces for acoustic cello, unlooped, you know, unaccompanied acoustic cello, I'm using lots of these types of techniques to get some color and some variety into the music, only when it's necessary, but they're there and they're available, so we must use them.
Right, you use all the I mean, the cello has been one of my major discoveries about, because I always heard the acoustic cello, and there are some times that I heard electric cellos play, especially from some Japanese, I don't remember now, some artists, but I never paid so much attention to the cello since I started listening to Chopin.
Well,
it's
good.
Yeah, at my late age, I started now to know about the cello, let me tell
you. Great. I'm really happy.
Yeah, it's still early. I mean, you still got time to learn more and more about it.
We never stop learning, Jose. That's the thing. We never, ever stop learning. And that's all there is. It's brilliant.
Yeah. How many times do you change your cello strings?
Oh, God.
Every other month? Or change all of them, some of them? Or
right. So I've got here, funnily enough, this is two strings. So I'm very lucky. There's a company called Didario Orchestral who look after me for strings. And so the first answer to your question is I change them only when it's necessary, which is not like a guitar. So some of the guitarists I tour with will change their strings before every performance. I will change my cello strings probably 3 weeks before I begin a tour, and then I will leave them on for as long as I possibly can. What does happen, because I use a lot of what's called scordatura, which is basically pulling the strings, lowering and raising.
Right.
So this stretches the string. So because I get through strings this way more frequently on my acoustic cello, they will stay on there for a year or more.
Okay.
Unless they get dirty or the string becomes dull, you know, but because they're hundreds of pounds for a set. So Didario, I have a performance requirement coming up using the bottom two strings as scordatura. So they're tuned down a whole step. And I ask them, do you have heavyweight strings? Because I need these strings to tune down.
Okay.
Which obviously alters the whole way that the cello has been set up, even on the electric, because the physics, everything is calculated. The tonnage of pressure that is on the bridge, the fingerboard, everything else, this changes when you begin to move your strings. So I need strings that will stay on there and they will stay in tune. So this is what I'm actually going to change this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
The bottom two strings on that cello for these Kaplan heavy gauges, and then play hard on them and see if they stay in tune, which I believe they will.
Are these, you're talking about steel cores, strings, right? Strings, right?
No,
impossible.
They're the same. These are actually for acoustic instruments. So the strings, these are very, very nice strings. They are D'Addario's equivalent of like the Perastro Perpetuals or some of the other string people that I've worked with in the past. These are very nice strings. They have a big projection. Even though I'm playing an electric cello in this capacity, I must still have, I can't have cheap, bad strings. The sound, it matters. It really matters. And you wouldn't think it because there's no body, obviously, no resonant body on the instrument, but it's still the way the string behaves is very, it varies greatly.
Are there any changes in the performance with the depending with the temperature or no? Like if it's too hot or too cold or
it can. I mean, cold is horrible. Cold and too hot is horrible as well. But the strings, you can find that you slip out of tune. I noticed that more on the acoustic cello actually. The electric cello because the top of the where we tune up has got machine heads like a bass guitar,
right.
Whereas my acoustic cello has 200-year-old wooden pins. It's a fallacy to think that wood stops doing anything when it's cut from the tree because it moves,
expands,
and it breathes,
expands
and contracts all the time. Whereas with metal machine heads, it's also much quicker if we are out of tune to just pull it back in. If a string has slipped, I can hear it instantly, obviously, and so I just pull the string back in again. So there are several videos on YouTube where I'm in the middle of a piece and I'll just do something that looks like some very nice open string, but it's because I know something's come out and I've got to find it in the middle of the piece, you know.
that's amazing. Now that we're talking about the cello and setting up, how long does it take you to set up your instruments, your gadgets and pedals every time you go on stage? How long does it take?
That's quick. That's very quick because I just have two pedals now, thanks to the technology in the RC600, the loop station. So I use GT1000 multi effects.
Right.
Stereo in and stereo out of that into the RC600 loop station, stereo out of that to front of house, and I take the headphone output for my monitoring, and I'm able to, that the RC600 has a mixing desk built in, so I can have the loops at different level than you get front of house. I have a click track that you don't get front of house and all these sorts of things. So basically it's like 5 minutes on, five minutes off. It's super quick, thankfully.
So when you move around, when you go to all the different venues and stages, what type of vehicle do you use to carry all that? Just a regular, like a van, or everything fits?
So normally, It depends how long the tour is. So I just did a tour in November where it was a headline tour, and obviously we had a lot of merchandise, so we needed to take a van for that, a six-seater van. But usually if I'm going, say I go to Manchester to play a gig here at home, well, I'll go in my car. It's easy because I've got a Skoda Roomster, which has got a big back end. So it's, I also travel usually with two sculptures as well, which were also made by my blacksmith, these whirling pieces of metal. And we can actually get everything in the car, but this is largely due to the skills of Alan Pride, who does my tour management and sort of logistics and stuff, because that man can pack a vehicle like I've never seen anyone pack a vehicle. It's like if there was an Olympic sport for vehicle packing, he would be a gold medalist.
that's funny. Being on tour, we're gonna talk about her new musical project. It's called Invocation Supplication. Yeah. We're going to talk about that. So much stuff. I don't know where to go next. I just listened to a song from a Norwegian band, Enslaved. Is that the last project you made with any bands? Because there are so many that I listened to. Is this the last one or no? Because I listened like a couple days ago to a song called Forest Dweller.
Forest Dweller, yeah.
Is this one of the newest or this is was done a long time ago?
No, it was a very recent one. So that was last year, in March last year, 2023. Enslaved invited me to perform a concert for them when they were doing an album launch, and also to join them on stage and play two tracks with them. Okay. So, which I did, and it was wonderful. It was over in Bergen. We had a great time. Lovely, wonderful band. Very, very highly skillful people, but also very nice people as well, which is lovely. Anyway, so I wrote these parts for Forest Dweller and another track. And then after the concert, a couple of weeks later, they asked would I record them because they had an idea to do a deluxe album. So the album cycle, I mean, albums will take a minimum of a year between the concept and the delivery of the final thing. That's if you've got the stuff recorded already.
Of course. Hmm.
So in their case, it was re-recording some stuff, remixing some stuff, adding other guest people in and out, you know. Hmm. So that came out yesterday or the day before yesterday,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I heard it a couple of days ago, yes.
Yeah, so that's there will be another one out from them at the same time, which is pretty bad timing. Another track that I'd collaborated on also came out. So I have to plan, in these instances, I have to plan how to do the PR. So because Enslaved had a PR schedule that was set, so this is good. So we've gone with that one, but in a couple of days' time, you will see some information about another collaboration I've done with a very different artist and an Iranian dancer, and so that will come
out. Well, yeah. You get so many requests, I guess, from many artists. But I have a little off question. Once you have committed to these projects, probably months, weeks, months in advance, right?
Yeah.
And you have to, once you get to, it's like an obligation after that. You have to show up or whatever you have to do. Is there times like you wake up in the morning and you look outside and you say, it's a beautiful day outside. I want to maybe go for a walk. I don't know. Go with my family, spend some time, some couple hours with them. But I have this, I have to do with this band or with this artist. And I'm like, oh man, I don't feel like I have to do it, but today is are there days that you just don't want to do these commitments? Like things once you get into it and you do it, then you're happy and you know you are a professional, so you really enjoyed it. But are there times in them like you feel like, man, I wish I could do this instead of that, you know?
Well, you know, so two things. First thing is, you remind me of a tour manager, the front of house man, very, very close to my heart, where he says, it's a lovely day, just right for 10 hours in the van, you know, because that's normally what happens on tour. Anyway, to answer your question, I work on my own agenda. So if I wake up in the morning and it's a beautiful day and Isla, my daughter, and I want to go to the woods, to the seaside, we will go.
Okay.
And then a lot of the time I work into the evening. So when I work, when I take sessions on these days, before I take the session on, I ask the artist or the producer, what is the time frame, hard deadline, what are you asking me to do? Are you asking me to play dots on a page that someone has written, or are you asking me to write parts? Are you going to change the arrangements? So I know a lot of information. It's very flattering because a lot of the time people ask me because they want me to do my stuff. They just say, we don't know, just do Joe.
Do what you love doing.
Yeah. But to be honest with you, very honest, I more frequently, unfortunately, have to say no to projects because my own work schedule is huge as well.
Of course.
So I have, for example, at the moment, I have an album that I'm finishing, not mine. It's for a great post-rock band. I've been very heavily involved in every single track. That they are my priority. Then there's a couple of other things, but there are a few things that unfortunately I can't do. Luckily, I have two very, very great cellists that I have no hesitation to say to my clients, I cannot help you, but here, you know, speak with this girl. She's phenomenal. And so it's very nice position to be in, you know, to be able to do that. So
very, very interesting. I know you're very devotional to your music. How many hours do you practice? Do you practice every day? Are you the type that plays every day?
Yeah, I do, because I want to and I love playing. And practicing, I mean, if I'm preparing for a tour and I've got new pieces in there, then I practice like as much as I can. Funnily enough, though, I mean, this is being very honest with you, but if you work as a freelance musician, then playing your instrument is usually the last thing that you're able to do each day, because there's so much other stuff with PR, social media, blah, blah, right. blah, blah, blah. And so actually sitting down and playing the cello, for me, what I do now is it is the first thing I do after my daughter's gone to school. Hmm. Before anything else happens, I will sit down and I will play my cello. I could play for hours every day. I don't play for hours every day because I don't have enough time with everything else. But what I do know is that you can be very efficient. You can get more done in, say, four lots of 20 minutes through a day than you could if you said, I've got four hours to practice. I don't think I'd make good use of that. If I know I've got 20 minutes here, 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 and here, I will do solid work with that. But I have to play every day, because otherwise I don't feel well in my head, you know?
Somebody told me about the same thing. They will do like 20, 30 minutes.
That's because we've spent probably since a very, very young age consistently doing the same thing. So if you counted up the hours and hours I've spent playing the cello, I mean, the reason I can get away with 20 minutes four times a day is because I've spent the last like 40 years doing it, you know.
Do you play more at daylight or at dark? Are you like an early morning person?
I have 2 days in every day. So I get up very early in the morning and then I work. And that's usually on acoustic cello and arrangements and stuff. Then I have a sit down in the afternoon, quite happy to admit that. And I might watch a bit of telly, or I might prepare the evening meal. My daughter comes home. Harry, we have the evening time and she goes to bed and I start again. So basically I go to bed late. I wake up early, but I also take a chunk out of the middle of the day. The rest. So it's like and in the evening I find is when I can work really well if I'm creating. The evenings, the darkness is good for that.
It's good for that. I've been listening to all her albums, you know, Caldera, Exalve, everything, Five Incantations, like she mentioned before, the Cartographer, which is a beautiful, I enjoy just the Cartographer for me. It's just the name. Just by thinking of the guy making, you know, I don't know, maps and charts, it's very interesting, just with the title.
Thank you.
I've been listening. I mean, it's hard to listen to Joe's music in the beach, let me tell you. It's not like a happy time that you... You know, going to the Caribbean, going to an island and listening to Joe, it doesn't work for me. I got to be, especially it's like more individual listening for me. I cannot listen to her music with some other guy sitting next to me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. I got to be by myself and in a quiet place. I cannot hear like an ambulance going through or something or a plane or, you know, noisy things around me. I cannot listen. You gotta be in a quiet place, especially some of them. Especially no lights. For me,
yes.
It helps a lot. If the sunshine in front of my face doesn't help, I need to be in a stage of I don't know. You know what I'm saying.
Cool.
You know. What I'm
I saying. Do. That's really cool.
Yeah,
I like that.
But that's how it is with some artists for me. You know. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed all her records. So much stuff that to listen to, and sometimes you spend more times like doing repeating a couple of those compositions, which some you love more than the others, or some days you like more this than the other day. So you know it's been a very learning experience for me to listen to Joe's music. So much stuff. I think you've been touring since December with a great guitarist.
John,
great guitar, fantastic.
Yes,
you were like the opening act, right?
No. It was a co-headline tour. So we took it in turns each night as to who would go first and who would play second. It was a very nice tour because my audience really enjoyed John's music, even though it's very different. John's audience very much appreciated what I was doing. So we had the last two concerts we did in London and Leeds a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
We had full house each night for both of us. We are both pushing at the boundaries of our instruments. We're both pretty down to earth people, and we both do basically weird things.
Of course,
so,
yes.
You know, it appealed across. Yes, thank you. It was a very good match. It'd be very nice. We have one more concert in Manchester, but I'm hoping that we can schedule some more dates together because that would be very, very special.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I knew about him. There is a guitarist that it reminded me from the 80s, and now I don't remember. He passed away. I don't remember. Hedges, something. Michael Hedges? I don't remember. From California. There is a way that he was playing also, which was very familiar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great guitarist. It was called the Parallel World.
That's right. Yes, yeah. That's what we were wanting to explain. Parallel worlds. That's exactly what we're doing.
Right.
You know, we're operating together.
Yeah.
Like this, but in very different ways.
Yeah, it's like great master musicians doing their line of work, you know.
Yeah.
So you were. That was a happy concert, a happy tour for you, I guess.
Yeah.
You enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I enjoy all the tours that I do. The tour a lot with Emma Ruth Rundell, of course.
Yes.
With very different artists.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Emma. So yes. I think I told her I had no idea who she was. Like I said, like 3 months ago. But then I noticed one of the videos I saw with Emma, and she was playing the cello. I didn't know who she was. Then it's the one that
it's the one on the album.
That's the one on the album. Oh, you know, so it is
great.
It was okay. You're going to be touring also in the coming months, right? You're going to be doing some shows also?
Or? I've got some shows. So I'm not touring, but I've got some shows.
Some shows.
It's interesting. You mentioned Invocation and Supplication. So,
yeah.
Well, first of all, I've got a few concerts. I've got Inferno Metal Festival in Norway, which will be very, very nice.
Oh, okay.
And then in May, I'm performing Supplication, which is the half of the record with Lorenzo Esposito Fonsari.
Yeah.
And so this record was two sets of three song cycles, and one set I wrote for Maria Franz from Heilung, and the other one for Lorenzo, for Lef, as we call him.
Right.
So in May, I'm performing the Supplication with Lef, and I have a 40-piece symphonic wind orchestra and percussion, and we're playing this whole record fully orchestrated in theatre.
I had a question. We're going to go back to that, but I had a question regarding the maestro conductor, Pinapple. How do you say it?
Yeah, Pinapple.
Incredible. I cannot figure it out. I was waiting for her to say it because I was going to destroy it. So
it's all right.
When was the first time you met him? He's very. Looks like a very interesting person to me.
He's my best friend. He's a wonderful man. I met him at university. So we were 19 and 22, you know, so as years and years ago. And we always got on really well. And he's very busy as orchestrator and conductor. He's also a great viola player, violin player too. But we always stayed in touch. And then he always got the side of things, the slightly kind of left of center side of things that I was doing. He understood it. And so when the very first thing that he was involved in with me was a performance with Kapela Gaudensis in Poland. So it was a Polish chamber orchestra and choir. And I wrote a piece of music for them called This Path of Grace. And Jos came and conducted it. And then we worked together in other settings. So he joined me. I put him in my quartet when we played with At the Gates and when we played for Mono. I worked with him as conductor. Then, of course, he was the conductor for The Cartographer. The relationship I have with him is such that I could not imagine undertaking any of these projects with anybody other than him, because he's a brave and a generous musician. But also when I write, for example, with the Cartographer, right. the last movement, we have a brass, some lots of stuff happens, then there's a big brass chorale, and right. then the whole ensemble comes in. And at that moment in time, I will start the loop station, because we have the click track from there, and there's no pre-roll, and Jos will have the click as well. And we start bang, and that's the downbeat. And we're not only that, but we're in 13/8, which is quite a tricky time signature to work in. So Jos is the only man I know, the only conductor I know, who is brave enough to, in front of 4,000 people, to say, yes, I can start this at the right time with you. And we know each other so well. It's very, very easy to work together. So yeah. He's a great man.
Great man. When I listened to the Cartographer, that was, you were commissioned by the Roebourne Festival in the Netherlands. Yeah. This is a festival that takes place every year, right?
Yes, that's right.
In the month of April. That sounds familiar. And the Cartographer, you play in 2022. That was the premiere of that. Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, they commissioned it in 2019, but obviously nothing happened for a few years, you know. So the premiere was moved to 2022. In that intervening period of time, I was able to go and record it, though, and I got some support from PRS Music Foundation here, so I could record it, which was great, because had we just gone straight into the premiere in 2020, we wouldn't have had a recording of it. And so actually I didn't change the score, but the 2 years hiatus meant that I could actually get the thing recorded. So and that's now, there it is, available for all.
Yeah, it's a great, for me it was very very cinematic. I really enjoyed it. Very emotional and sentimental for me. It was a great experience, those five movements.
Thank you.
Well, a single piece, but it's divided for the, you know, I guess five movements.
That's right. Yeah.
And, you know, the brass, like she was mentioning, the crossbones, trombones, and cymbals. It was beautiful. I really enjoyed it. I was feeling like it was left to my imagination and fantasy, I guess, listening to that. Very absorbing record.
Thank you.
Yeah. Those beautiful, I don't know, so much stuff, beautiful waves of sounds that they dig deep into me. Yeah, I don't know.
Super.
It's a great record to listen. I mean, if you never heard of Joe's music, I don't know. I don't know which one should be the first album you could listen to.
I wouldn't start with the Cartographer.
I wouldn't start with the. I was going to say maybe you should leave that for later. I don't know.
I'll tell you what. If people are curious, I think I would say that Gold is probably a good track to start with. Yeah, because it's very, very passionate piece of music, but it's also. It's quite a sensible introduction. It's not particularly atonal, and I can get quite atonal at times. So it's a nice way in, you know.
It's a nice way in. I started with the Cartographer. For me, it was great because, you know, for me, it's wonderful.
Good.
You know, I mean, you could go and listen to the Adderstone. Yeah, that's a beautiful song. You could start.
Thank you. That's not a bad start.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice video also. It's a very nice video, let me tell you.
It was well made when we shot that video. Yes, it was very well made. Yes. Richard Wakefield, he's brilliant. It costs quite a lot of money to make a video well, so that's why I don't make them very often, because there isn't no budget. I would love to have made one for Invocation and Supplication, but there was no budget to make a video. You know, so
maybe next.
Well, okay, next time. Yeah,
next time. There is a song there from Caldera called Loras. I think it
Loras. Loras. Yes.
Uh-huh. Is that based on a book? No.
No. The track itself is not based on a book. It's
I like that song. Well, there's so many of them. I don't know. Like I say, I don't know which one I will suggest, but like those two songs probably are good for some of my audience to start with.
Great, you know? Yes, good.
I think
good.
So.
Thank you.
Why not? Mm-hmm. Take a chance. Take a chance. Like I said, she's been playing with so many artists. If you type her name, Joe quill. Like I told a friend of mine, and she's like, yeah, just, I'm going to interview this great musician. And they're like, I spoke with a friend of mine, which is like a very classical guy, very Beethoven fan, you know, he loves Beethoven. He's like,
super.
And he's like, ask her, what does she think about Beethoven? I said, I'm not going to ask her. But it has nothing to do with what she has something to do with what she does. But what is she going to say? It's a terrible composer. I don't really like him. She's going to say it's a great composer. So what's the, and I'm asking her now, just for my friend. I don't know. I'm a good guy, so I got to ask her. What's your opinion of Beethoven? I don't know. I just out of the blue, you know, I don't know. Just to make him happy.
such a fascinating era of music. If you look, I mean, you can chart so much development if you look through Beethoven, the work of Beethoven, some of the quartets, the late quartets. Oh my God, to play them is beautiful. Not easy, you know, but absolutely stunning. The symphonies. I mean, we he's crossing, moving across what we now, with hindsight, would say are periods of music, you know, periods of classical music. Mm-hmm. And I think the weight of some of his later symphonies, anyway, that weight is something that I was really keen to try in my way to replicate the weight of that sound, especially in the cartographer. It's a very interesting point because Beethoven is case in point where heavy music is not defined by amplification or by volume. In fact, I mean, moving backwards from that, you could say that the Bach C minor cello suite, me, that is one of the heaviest pieces of music, particularly that opening, extremely heavy. It's one cello playing one note, you know, but it's heaviness is, this is what I explored with Roadburn's commission. So heaviness in music, because I play in metal festivals or classical music, doesn't matter. I play all over the place, but all the same thing is happening, which is that what we're talking about is weight and intensity, and the intensity of the composer, the intention of the composer, the intensity of the orchestration, the delivery, the performance delivery. That's heavy music. Heavy music isn't about how fast, slow, pitch, speed, any of these things at all. It's old MacDonald had a farm can be very loud and very fast, but that doesn't make it heavy, you know.
Right.
Whereas that one single note that's dropped like that, like a dead weight into an absolute thick pool of silence or a drone or something, that's heavy music. That's what you're describing when you're talking about dark, no lights on, or being by yourself, is being. Being able to immerse yourself into this, and that's what you can do with the work of Beethoven, or you know, and Mahler, you know, or any of these other colossal greats.
That will make him happy just to hear that.
Yeah.
That will make him, because he's always telling me he was a man ahead of his times. So I believe so very much.
But all of the greats, you see. We can look back now and say this about them. I mean, don't forget when the Magic Flute, Mozart, when the Magic Flute was premiered, nobody liked it.
Right.
You know, people were walking out, it's too long, it's too many notes. That's it. You know, people, I expect at the first moment when music moved from being, in the history of music, we're not talking about early cave, you know, stuff. Church, choral music, religious music. And then the split between that and sort of the magicals of non-sacred music. And then at the moment that the augmented fourth started to creep in, the forbidden interval, you know, suddenly this was a game changer, absolute game changer. Mm-hmm. So it goes on all through history in music. There have been moments which have been game changers, which were completely and utterly rejected by the people at that time. And it's only afterwards that you can see, my God, thank heavens that they did that, because now we have Schoenberg or 12-tone, whatever, you know. And that all was because one person at some point thought that it was okay suddenly to use the augmented fourth. So, you know, I mean, that was a bit of a kind of whitewash of the history of music there.
Yeah. Very interesting.
You find that.
I love it. I'm going all over the place. I have to apologize because I'm jumping from one thing to the other, because
it's all right.
So much stuff that you do. I, you know, we could talk about all the collaborations with you know, with monologues he mentioned, and some Indian also multi-instrumentalist from India, Arka sorry, I couldn't say his last name, Segupta, I think. Arka Segupta, is that what it's
So there is. There have been. I've done quite a few collaborations with multi instrumentalists and people all over the place, all over the world.
So many.
I know.
God is an astronaut. That beautiful, that great band from Ireland. I love that band. Post rock band. I love that band. Oh, it's so much stuff. I don't know. You're keeping
They're
me busy, Joe. You're keeping me busy lately. I have to go all over the listening to new music.
Sorry. Somebody did ask to me. They said once, do I have a catalogue of all the collaborations I've done? I was like, no, I don't. I'm really sorry. But if anybody wants to put one together, I'd be really grateful.
There's so much stuff she does, and she's always busy. Even crocheting, I'm like showing my wife, she crochets a shawl or something.
Yes, I love
because
crocheting.
My wife loves knitting.
She does
sweaters for me and scarves and stuff.
Beautiful.
So she's like, I'm interviewing Joe, but she also does crocheting. What? She does that. She does everything. I don't know. Maybe she's a great cook also. I don't know. I don't know if she cooks.
I am a good cook.
I don't know.
I enjoy cooking very, very much indeed. But these are all things. It's the same thing. It's creating, isn't it? So whether
cooking
it's crochet,
is creating, right?
It is creating. It's and you could invest as much love and energy and energy into what you cook is what you play music. Yeah. And I mean, everyone has to eat, don't they? So why not? Let's make it nice. It's a time we sit together.
Especially when you cook, you got so many different things that you can add. You know, like to a stew. Precisely. I don't know. You can add a little pepper, a little hot spices, or remove. You can do so many things, so many combinations. Sometimes it's like cooking; it comes out really bad. It tastes horrible, and sometimes you do music, and the same thing happens. So you gotta choose the right ingredients, I guess.
You do. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
So it's very interesting. Let's talk about. So much stuff. I want to talk about her newest project, Invocation and Supplication, which for me is, I don't know how to explain it. Maybe she has to do it for me. There is a big difference listening to Invocation or Supplication, I think. Both are great. But it reminds me when I listen, I don't know how to say it. I'm like... crying for help. I have no idea. Like you are in a purgatory, like in the Christian beliefs, or like you are in the middle, in between heaven and hell. I don't know. Explain to me, please.
So invocation and supplication, I mentioned this earlier. They are three song cycles. Invocation was written for Maria Franz, who is Invocation is a very earthy and sort of primal series of songs. Supplication was written for Lef. Supplication is, they're two sides of the same coin. And I talk about this in the sleeve notes, but they're, if you like, the sort of pagan versus the orthodox religious side. I'm not, I don't have a religion, a traditional religion, but I have great respect for religion and for the concept of deities, you know, so I understand this. When I wrote for both of them are with Maria, with Invocation, it's very much like the divine feminine archetype, if you like. And Macha, the first track, I mean, she's a warrior. Right. Warrior queen, the first Celtic warrior queen. We have basically maiden, mother, and crone bound up within Invocation. With Supplication, it's much more of a journey. We have the calling, Maestoso and Kyrielasti. They are, it's as though one gets closer to seeing the face of God, if you like, through that's what I, what somebody said to me. I did not intend to do this, but somebody said this to me in their review of it. And I understand what they mean, because it's impact. Lef sings, it's very, it's you're held in this state. I mean, musically speaking, we don't even cadence till right at the end of the third movement. So it's holding in this state, in this key, where different things are explored, you know, and moving around. And then his baritone voice, so beautiful. He soars like a great cry.
Like a cry, yes.
Yeah. I mean, working with him, he interpreted what I had written for him with such power. Because when you're writing and you do mock-ups and you're using general MIDI, or perhaps slightly better, you're using East West or you're using BBC SO, but you're not hearing things as they truly will be. And then, so I was working with these mock-ups that I'd created for ages, and then Lef sent his vocal back to me, and it was like, oh my God, you know. And the same when I recorded Maria, I went to Lava Studios. Christopher Yule recorded Maria for me. And the pieces are set on fire when you have these vocalists of this caliber. Phenomenal, you know.
Did you have a good time creating these compositions? Like, enjoy them, or?
Yeah, I love them. I mean, they both of them were created actually during from 2020 and over a period of about 18 months. I had no embargo because there were no concerts, you see. So I couldn't perform a concert. So therefore, I wrote exactly what I wanted to write. So I just finished writing The Cartographer, and I just kept going from there. So Invocation has got French horn, trombones, loads and loads of percussion.
Yeah, very orchestral. Yeah, very orchestral. Yeah.
The interesting thing is that every single thing was recorded at home or in people's houses. Everybody who was kind of high up on in the music food chain said, oh, you can't do that. I think, you know, you need to be in a studio with a choir, you know. And I was like, oh, well, thanks very much. I don't believe you. And I was right. You can do everything. You don't have to be in a studio. Yes, it's very nice to be in a big studio. Of course it is, but it's not necessary. My choir, they sent their syllables on mobile phones to me, and I made a choir out of them. That's what you hear on the record, is people who sang into their mobile phones. No more than that, and I built a choir. It was this real very freeing experience. And of course, then when it came to Lef's EP, if they were running at the same time, being composed simultaneously, and then Supplication, much more intimate affair by rights, because so it should be. We had a very broad outward facing one, then the inward facing one, and just working, and really for that one, the harmonic movement was very simple and very, I wanted to explore these slow and simple movements of sound. And that's so I was doing two things at the same time, completely different things.
So I was going to ask you, does it have anything to do, is there a connection with the pandemic for somehow?
No.
Nothing to do with that.
I'll tell you what was the one that you might be referring to, the one that was connected to the pandemic, is a piece of music that's only available. Oh, it's on Bandcamp, but on YouTube. It's called The Parados Cairn, C-A-I-R-N. Okay. That was the piece of music that was very important for me. So this piece of music I created in the early months of 2020, and I asked people to send me sound on their mobile phone. And from this piece, from all their sounds, we got 167 sounds from all across the world, people sent in. And I created an entire piece of music out of all these sounds. Oh. That was, so that is, it was so important, Jose, so important to me to write that piece, to produce that piece of music. And it was very important, it turns out, to the people who had sent the sounds, because I would do little updates as we were going along. And people felt, at a time when we were all completely cut off from one another, this was something which was bringing us together, albeit online, but it was bringing us together. So musically, I think The Parados Cairn actually is the most important piece I've ever put together. And it's the one I didn't play a single note on, but it's the one that started many processes for me, but will remain at forever a captured moment in time of that time.
I just have a question regarding the pandemic. Just one question for you. During the pandemic, do you feel like your musical accomplishment didn't have the same value that you thought? Like,
there were 100%. I'm not alone in this, because when the pandemic came, everything I thought that I stood for and everything I thought I was not there. You know, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was a touring artist. What was important, and I know this is for a fact, what is important is for me is to be able to play concerts, share time, share space with people. Right. That was not possible. So, you know, obviously there was a long period of time where creativity was impossible. Playing the cello was impossible for me, which is why, again, I refer back to the Paradox Chem. That was why I did that, because I was not able to do anything that I would normally do.
So you your creativity really suffer at that time?
Yes, and no. It did suffer, but on the other hand, when I started to put the Parados together, a whole new world of creativity opened up to me, because I had, previous to that, I'd never been so fully involved in production and sound design as well, things like that. And so that side then opened up, which then, of course, fed into what I did with Invocation and Supplication.
So you learned like a lot of different other methods of composition, I guess, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Probably maybe music software and stuff like that? Or
Exactly. I mean, I'd started to learn Cubase inside out. I learned a lot about production. Not saying I'm a brilliant producer now, but I'm certainly a lot better than I was back then.
So you're going to get more requests then. If you're like a producer, then you're going to get more work even.
I would love to, right? I'd like to do, I'd like to be an executive producer for some people, because I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I wouldn't want to sit in a studio and say to somebody, I'm going to, you know, engineer you. But in terms of production, I have lots and lots of ideas that I'd love to explore. When I listen to people's records, I think, oh, that was brilliant. I'd love to talk about that with them. Or, oh, I could hear something just in that bit there. Or I wonder if they thought about, or this mix. Right. I wonder what it would be if we brought this to the fore, you know, stuff like that. So it's what I do in my own work. But, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a very deeply personal thing, production. So I think you have to, you need to work closely with the people that you produce, or that, for me, the people that work alongside me as producers are, I mean, I'm a control freak about my production. So I will ask somebody to come in because I do not know how to do what I want it to do. So, and then they come in and then they will often have great ideas, and that's brilliant. And we take it even further. But I have to say, I have a very firm hand on the steering wheel.
Regarding Invocation and Supplication, there are songs that I really enjoy most. I really love that one. Love it.
Thank you. That's interesting.
Composition. It's like clears my mind when I listen.
This is nice. No, maybe because so this is very interesting. Again, Willow of All. She's a beautiful singer, and from a technical point of view, what's interesting with Willow of All is it's built on a whole tone scale, so the intervals are open. So perhaps what you're feeling is you're hearing the openness, and also at every point that we cadence, we move down. So your listeners will be familiar. We move down effectively in a whole tone scale. It's not as straightforward as that, but that's what we're doing. And so each point we cadence down a tone, but it continues, you see, it's constant cadencing. So we're going deeper and deeper, opening further this sound world.
That explains it a little
this
for
is what
me.
What you like? Yeah,
really. Uh-huh. No, they are the track also. Maestoso is that.
Maestoso.
I say it in Spanish. Maestoso.
Maestoso is very.
It's a fantastic piece.
Oh, thank you.
It's very dreamy. Very dreamy. Like I don't know, blissful, I guess we could say. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. It was when I wrote that particular one, I just finished making an arrangement. It's on Bandcamp of Thomas Tallis motet, Agnus Dei. And so I was dealing with a lot of parallel rhythmic movements and early kind of choral music. And I think it just fed into that. But that piece did exactly what I've always wanted a piece like that to do. And that one nailed it. So,
so how can you say that all these tracks came from the inner thinking of you, like more inner part, 100%. Your interior, more than the outside? More than the external factors, more from the inside, right?
Yes, deeply so.
Deeply, I could feel it. It's like, I don't know. It's just very intense.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
I really did.
Thank you so much.
And I really think my listeners should take a listen.
I hope they enjoy it.
Yeah. Start with the lighter songs, the lighter like we mentioned.
Start with Gold.
Start with Gold. Don't jump into those.
Yeah, make your way to Maestoso, and then
you gotta walk. You know, cut the brushes a little bit. Yeah. You know, start the walking a little bit. I don't know how to. I'm going crazy. No, I don't know what I'm saying.
That's great. Listen, it's such a pleasure to chat with you. I'm going to have to go because my daughter is coming.
Of course,
any minute now. But
not a problem. I really enjoyed it. I know we're taking so much time. It's my fault. I'm sorry.
No, it's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. It was a pleasure talking to Joe about all these things. I wish maybe next time we'll have another talk in a couple of years. Who knows?
Sure.
I just thank you for making the time and keep making great music.
Thank you.
You got a great fan over here.
Thank
you, know?
You so much, Jose. I look forward to meeting you in person. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we're going to close on a day and we'll talk again next week. Nothing better than today. So if you just stay here, keep listening. Don't even bother with the next interviews. This is what's great. Thank you very much. See you next week.
All right. God bless everybody.